And welcome. This is the first of what promised to be many wonderful talks throughout the day. Our speakers for the rest of the day are all really just remarkable, uplifted, higher consciousness people. So come to as many as you can. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Shanti Rubinstone, and I am introducing all of the speakers today. And I very conveniently forgot to get anybody to introduce me. So I get to do that for myself, which is a favorite way for me to go anyway. I am one of the spiritual directors at Ananda here in Palo Alto. I've been with Ananda since the late 1970s. So I met Yogananda first, met him down in Encinitas, and then promptly moved up here and became part of first the village and then the Ananda Palo Alto community when it opened. That's very meaningful in my life. And what is also meaningful, and particularly today, is that I happen to be a physician, I always say in my spare time. Part of why I came up here was to go to medical school back in the 70s. And it's just been a true joy for me. As I tell people all the time, it's interesting and absolutely true for me and clear how medicine, as I've practiced it, and ministry are just seamless. If you bring to medicine that which says, let me help, let me meet each person and help them live to their own highest potential, body, mind, and soul, which is really what all of us are doing on a spiritual path as well. So I've been able for all of these years to just go from medicine, an office, a hospital, wherever it is, and then into our church without realizing that I'm changing places, because really we don't. So it's been a tremendous joy for me to bring these two modalities together in spirit. What is also interesting for me is that in the 1970s, which to me doesn't feel all that long ago, it was before some of you were even born, that was not the case for me, nobody was talking about meditation in medicine. It was very odd. If you did that, you were the odd man out. I remember at Stanford, where I went to medical school, you were allowed to offer a course as a student if you could get a faculty member to support you. And I wanted to talk about the role of yoga and meditation in health and well-being. Let me just say, it took a few months to find anybody who was willing to support it. And what's fascinating and lovely, in really a very short order, these few decades that we've been through, is that both meditation and yoga, mostly hatha yoga, but to some degree the philosophy behind that, and mostly mindfulness meditation, but really all forms of meditation now, and I'm going to show you some of this in just a few minutes, are not just being accepted into the medical field, but every university, hospitals, clinics, they're actually hiring people to come and have programs for their clients, otherwise called patients. And it's just been a beautiful thing for me to be able to watch this transition. And I realized, I first put this talk together for a program we did maybe about a year ago called Meditation and Science or something like that, up at Ananda Village, where there were going to be a lot of scientists there. I don't know who all of you are, but up there it was for physicists and other scientists. So I did my research. That many of these programs in medicine are still run through a medical model. So there's very strict ways, and they have to be able to be tested in certain ways and for them to work. And I'm not opposed to that. I mean, I was born and raised at Stanford, so I too am a scientist. But it gets a little tricky with meditation at times and people's subjective experience of it. And how do we define that? How do we talk about meditation or wellness or quality of life? It's a little complicated. But part of what I realize that thrills me is that if you have these physicians and other scientists who are constantly writing prescriptions for these things, sharing these modalities, encouraging their patients to go take a course in meditation or to go work with a yoga therapist or whatever it is, and then the patients come back and they're actually doing better in many instances. And again, we'll see data. They feel much better. And when they feel better, the doctors start realizing something's actually going on here. This isn't just bogus. It's not just, you know, somebody sits in a quiet room and they feel a little better. Blood pressure actually drops. Pain decreases. The rate of cancer spread and growth slows. And now we're getting more and more and more data for all of this. So I feel like for whatever reason they send their patients for a meditation class or a yoga class, and then maybe even sneak in one on themselves, that's a good thing. So we're sort of coming in the back door in medicine, but we're getting in, and that matters a great deal. Now, here's something else that's happened in medicine since I went to medical school. When I went to medical school, we were taught that by the time you were in your 20s, I mean, we were taught this in neuroanatomy, neurophysiology, neurology, your brain was what it was. You had already passed. That means there we were, poor students trying to cram in all these facts. We were already after our prime, they were telling us. You're going to have a lot of trouble learning this, they would say to us. And I would be there saying, no, I'm not. No, I'm not. This is wonderful. This is easy. You know, I did not want to hear that. But really, I'm not saying it to be funny. That was the teaching then. The teaching was the brain cells matured. Nothing changed about them after that. You know, nobody would have ever thought of trying to teach somebody my age, I'm now 70, a new language or a new way to play music. Everybody just thought it would make people crazy. Excuse me. I'm so wired here, I forget which thing I'm supposed to cover. To me, it was just all the more possibility for things to go wrong, but it had to be in this way. Anyway, and we lived with that belief for a long time. And now, I would say maybe the last 20 years, and really the last 10 or 15 years, where we're using phrases like neuroplasticity, meaning, guess what, the brain can change. And in fact, we can not only develop new neurons in our brain, but we can teach our brain cells how to rely on each other. Another new thing. This is crucial to understand how meditation works, which is what we're really here to talk about. But we have to understand the brain cells actually form what Dr. Peter, who was, he's another physician who was my main teacher for many years. I said, thank God he's interested in this science, because I didn't think I was. But the truth is, it's so fascinating. You have to decide you're interested in it because it's wonderful. And I felt like it was my responsibility. But, I mean, to be able to teach this, I had to learn a little more. But Peter says, and it's true, that our brain cells are not just isolated. Like, here's a group of neurons in a certain hemisphere in your brain that are going to teach you languages. That is actually true, depending on whether you're right or left-handed, your speech centers on one side of your brain or the other, depending actually on what language you're speaking and learning. Those neurons can be in various places in your brain. But it used to be, if anything happened to those cells, that was it. You either couldn't speak, you could never learn another language, you might lose some of your own language. Not so. That's what we thought. So we behaved that way. Somebody had a stroke, right-handed, have a left-sided stroke, person can't speak, it was hopeless. But it's not at all hopeless. Now we realize that there are many ways to invite other neurons in. Hey, you've taken your time over there. You're not learning how to play a new instrument right now. Come on over here. We need you in the speech department. And things like this, it really works. The brain cells start working together. Can you imagine the implication of that? That you can take somebody who's become what we call completely aphasic after a stroke, and now we know, we're not just asking questions, we can teach those people how to speak again. We can adjust for motor neurons that teach muscles to move. Everything in the brain, everything, unless it happens in the medulla, and it's not to say everybody can be rehabilitated. There are such things as massive strokes. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying it's so much better than it was before. There are enormous implications to what we're about to hear. Now, it turns out that one very good way to begin to have an impact on the brain is through meditation. And the very good, there's everything in the world good about that, because, you know, I often tell my patients who are resistant to wanting to learn to meditate or resistant to seeing somebody who might do some acupuncture or use any other modality, I say, isn't it fascinating? Let me parenthetically say this before I move on. I'm sorry. Hold the thought where I was. I love Western medicine. I'm all for it. When it's what's indicated, I am not against medicine. I not only don't feel critical of it, I'm in awe of it. I bow at a lot of my colleagues' feet at Stanford. It's beautiful work that Western medicine does, okay? I'm not going to apologize anymore or explain anymore after that. But I say to my patients, you're absolutely willing to go and try any one of these drugs that could have the most serious side effects. So much of what we do in medicine, when it works, it's beautiful. If you have an appendicitis, don't see your acupuncturist. You know, you want to find a surgeon. If you have a really big, strong cancer that's taken over, you may want to see a naturopath, an herbalist, an acupuncturist, anybody who practices energetic medicine. But you probably want to see an MD as well. Cancer is a strong force, and it needs a strong force to stop it in its tracks. Then these other more subtle healing energies can come in and do what they're meant to do. So we're not for or against anything. We're for whatever it is the person needs. But meditation is not ever going to hurt anybody, with one caveat in there. One caveat, and I'll show you a slide. It is true that people who have active and serious psychiatric delusional problems, if they're actively hallucinating, probably we do not want to teach them meditation. We don't want people getting less grounded and going into any of their delusions, religiosity, grandeur, whatever it happens to be. You don't want to do that. So we need to be mindful, really, in that one instance. Otherwise, no reason at all not to try meditation. And before I actually start through this slideshow, a lot of people ask me, you know, it's very hard to learn to meditate. I won't ask you, or to develop a practice. It's not hard to learn the techniques. But to develop a practice and to stick to it, it's hard. I often say to God, why did you make something so good for us so difficult? It seems unfair. And so many people walk in and they say, I can't sit. I cannot sit. Many people say to me, I'm not meant to meditate in this life. I'm not supposed to meditate. Yes, you are, in fact, maybe challenging. But guess what? It's good for all of us. And yes, it's difficult. Our minds do what they do very well, which is think tens of thousands of thoughts in a day. It's just running the race for us. It's dictating what we do. That's the mind's job. So it's just doing it well. Now it's our job to come in and figure out how to tame the beast. And here's the good news. Every study that's done, everyone, I must have read 100 studies on meditation to prepare this talk, some whenever that was, a year ago or so, comes up with this figure that if people can meditate, and it varies just a little, mostly it's 12 to 15 minutes, but some studies say 18 minutes a day. 12 to 15 minutes a day will change your life. I'm going to show you a lot of the medical studies because that's what I'm here to do. But you can already see how much you can learn a new instrument if you always wanted to. Learn a new language. I'll show you studies that say it will teach us how to concentrate, how to focus, how to be more aware, how to accomplish everything we want to accomplish in much less time with greater creativity. And you know that issue where you're just introduced to somebody and 2 minutes later they walk away and you're saying to somebody, what was their name? You know, we're not present in most moments. That's not what we do. Our minds are racing. So besides all of the ways that it will have an impact medically that I'm going to start showing you now, it changes our lives in ways that are nearly indescribable. Suddenly, people say, I just was talking to a woman today who's been watching a lot of our classes online, and she said, I'm just watching your classes. She had never been to any Ananda facility before today. She said, all of a sudden, my children are coming up to me and saying, Mom, what's happening to you? You're so much more calm. People will come up and say, did you cut your hair or something? You know? And what they're reading is this calmness, this upliftedness, this sense of deep, abiding inner peace. We don't even feel it. Suddenly, somebody behaves with us in a way that would have just had us be so reactive not that long ago. And all of a sudden, we get home and we thought, wow, my boss actually didn't bother me today. In fact, she's actually a pretty great lady. You know, this boss that was driving us nuts. So some of it, as we begin to learn how to focus our energy, how to take charge of it, how to bring it more into the very core of who we are, and we literally begin to change from the inside out. One of our speakers tonight on the panel, her name is Gwynne Guibord. I'll introduce her, so I'm not going to tell you a lot. But she founded a center. It's a big interfaith center in Los Angeles. And it's called Religion from the Inside Out. And really, that's what that means. It means when you get to the core of it, and it's interfaith, every living being is exactly the same. Every living being, not just humans, we all come, everything that's living, actually everything that's not living, but that's for another talk, is, I can't be too limiting here, you know, we're talking about infinity, so go figure. But that every being, doesn't matter what we call ourselves, it doesn't matter what religion we're practicing, doesn't matter at all. If we're genuinely practicing that true religion, whatever it is, those teachings are about getting to the core of who we are and knowing that we are peace, that we are light, that we are perfectly well. No matter what happens to this body, we are not this body. That's what we're not. So, this slide was supposed to be up there to be helping you feel calm. I hope it did that. Okay. We hang this in front of our church to invite people to come in. Okay. And just a few fun slides to begin with. Can you all read these? It's on a pretty big screen. And this is what we're going to find out. This is what we'll see when we get into some of the history. You can go as far back as you want. You can go into any religion. You can speak to, you know, Jesus. I mean, you could speak to them, but if you're speaking to them, let me know. I'd love to spend some time with you. But do the teachings of Jesus, of Buddha, of Krishna, of Moses, Muhammad, any one of these great spiritual teachers, and many, many more. I'm just naming the names that we know. And you know what? They're all going to tell us the same thing. They know the truth. Truth is one, though paths to it are many. So science, and we love this, those of us who teach it, we love that science is catching up. I really started falling in love with so many physicists. I thought, wow, now finally I can get up and talk a little physics and people will listen, at least from the beginning, because I have science to back it up. People need that. So it's a very good thing. But these truths that the scientists are discovering, the 12, 15, 18 minutes blood pressure, on and on, the great saints have been telling us this. Be still and know that I am. Isn't that what Jesus said? I mean, that's what it is. What does that mean? It means you sit very still. You find that place within yourself that is well, and you will discover something that connects us all and that has you being able to deal with every situation in life, no matter how awful it is. And there's many awful things that happen and are happening right now. But no matter what it is, I was talking to the young man who's been so wonderful helping us set all this up. First he came in, he goes, no, the Ethernet's not going to work. Oh, no, you can't have your laptop up here. Oh, no. And I said to him, you know, let's just try. But the good news for you today is we're all yogis. So no matter what happens, nobody's going to yell at you. He said to me, really? I said, yeah, watch us. This is what happens. How bad can that be, right? Yeah. Okay, this is a little bit, just briefly, about the history of meditation. I won't spend a long time here because I want to show you some of the medical slides, but again, looking around the room, I don't know who's old enough to remember, but many people really walked onto a spiritual path either through Ram Dass, who's not on this slide, who was getting his PhD at Harvard, took a little acid and started really having these divine experiences, left Harvard and went to India, which was the best move he ever made, and he would still tell you that today. Herbert Benson, who was a cardiologist at Harvard, I met him and spent a lot of time with him, also still alive, and he's the one who, after several hippies knocked on his door and said, why are you guys struggling with hypertension so much? I can show you how to treat hypertension. He turned them away twice. The third time he said, okay, come in. And they started teaching him the concept of saying a mantra. And lo and behold, it worked. And now you have to go through their mindfulness clinic to be treated for your hypertension there. All these years later, he's really been one of the big proponents of speaking about all of the good that meditation can do. Actually, a very, very great man in his own right. Same with Jon Kabat-Zinn, who's another person. He started a lot of the mindfulness institutes and clinics that are around. And, oh, this is just a lovely picture for those of us who remember the Beatles with the Maharishi. Is this perfect or what? Really, a lot of people started, they were involved. They were here after Yogananda left his body, but they were involved, and somebody helped me out. The cover of their album, Sergeant Pepper, has all of our line of gurus on the cover. So they were discovering something. They knew something, and they helped us see it through their music. And this is, of course, Paramahansa Yogananda. I don't know how many of you know about him or of him. This is just a picture of this great spiritual classic, autobiography of a yogi that he wrote. He came here in his 20s, in 1920, and as David said in his opening talk this morning, was the first Eastern saint, a true avatar actually, who came here and then spent the rest of his life here. And he came to bring a practice of meditation to the West. That practice was Kriya Yoga, which is intended to help us all experience the truth of what meditation can do for you. Not just hear words, not just try and believe somebody because you like how they're talking and you'll follow them anywhere for a while, but when the rubber hits the road and you actually have to sit still for 10 minutes, you change your mind. He came to give us a technique that said, do this technique, breathe in a certain way, practice it, and you will discover your true nature. And he really, I don't know how many tens or hundreds of thousands of people he taught to meditate, and then through his disciples and Swami Kriyananda, who founded Ananda, actually lived the last few years of Yogananda's life with him. So everything you're seeing around you today, everything you see globally that's Ananda, one piece of what came through this very great master. This slide is a little old. It's 2012, but I looked it up this morning, and the top number, well, it's how many people are actually meditating, what percentage. And in 2016, I just found an article that said 18% of the people that they interviewed were practicing some type of meditation. That doesn't include yoga, and we don't know what people call meditation and what they don't. They may have been taught mindfulness and not be calling it that. I have a feeling these numbers are a little falsely low, but still, compared to 20 years ago, 30 years ago, you know, it's remarkable. The number is on the rise, both because the word is out, but also because, I mean, we all know we're in a lot of trouble in the world. There's a lot of very, very difficult things going on. And when people discover a technique that allows them to live at the same moment as some of the atrocities that are going on right now, that this actually works, that they can actually use this, it starts drawing people. Really, literally, they bring their friends. This is what happens. It's much easier to be in the world if you have this practice, they tell people. So these numbers are really on the rise. This is just a slide that talks about how many different kinds of meditation there are. Mindfulness meditation is really caught on, and it's a beautiful practice, but it also doesn't ask anybody to believe in anything other than their own ability to sit still and breathe. So you're not asked to believe in anything bigger than you, and that makes it much easier for a lot of people to practice mindfulness than another form of meditation where we actually use words like the divine and God, and we have gurus. You know, it's harder, and I say that with a lot of respect for how much harder it is for people. So mindfulness definitely is big, and I'm so glad because they're doing such wonderful things for people, really wonderful things. But I'll show you some data in a little bit that says even when they look at other forms of meditation, even though a lot of these studies come out of the Mindfulness Institute and Herbert Benson's clinics and other people who are practicing mindfulness, there's a couple of studies that'll show you, and I've read many, other forms of meditation, mantra meditation, which is TM, and it's also a little bit about what we do. First thing we do when you walk in, first night, if you come to learn meditation or if you take a class, and I urge all of you to do that, a short little class, they'll teach you what's called Hung Sa. It's a mantra that you just repeat over and over. And you would be amazed at how calming it is, both by the repetition, also by the vibration of those beautiful Sanskrit words, which you can hear more about two or three doors down. Okay, this is, can you read this? Meditation in the Digital Age. Okay, I'll just let you read. You can't have a program in this area and not show this slide. Okay. This is a very complicated slide, but let me spend a minute just summarizing it for you. Basically, if you look on the left side of the screen, everything that happens to you during a stress response, everything that's on here, increased ACTH, increased epinephrine, norepinephrine, you don't even have to know what they are, but I can tell you they all give you the jitters. They raise your blood pressure, they have you feel lightheaded and dizzy, they have you feel racy, they take you into a place that you don't feel good in. That's what happens. Now, there are times where they happen to save your life, and that's wonderful. But meditating doesn't get in the way of that, I promise you. When you need them, they're still there. Everything on the right side of your screen is what happens when you practice. Again, this is a study that was done with the relaxation response. So you start practicing. Remember, I told you they've shown 12 minutes a day will let you land on the right side of this screen instead of the left, which is that there are ways that it helps you lower, and good data to show all this now. epinephrine, norepinephrine, decrease your cortisol response, all of those things. You've all heard of fight or flight, right? This is what happens when you're in that mode. It's like somebody puts their hands around your adrenal glands in your brain and says, give it all you got. And it's out of control. It's like anything running out of control. We say, how can we let you have these same hormones to the degree that you need them and use them in a way that's going to allow you to face the same situation? There was a study done where they took people who were meditating and they said, we want to do a study with you. And they talked to them a little bit about whatever. And they said, oh, come on into the next room. We're going to give you a little prize for participating in the study. And they walked into the next room and somebody shot a gun. And what they found is that when they compared non-meditators to meditators, so that's a really, that would be shocking to our nervous system. It would be very difficult. If you did not meditate, all of these hormones stayed sky high for certain periods of time. If you were a meditator, you still had the same hormonal response, but it normalized very quickly. And they also found that as they were doing EEGs and these functional MRIs, that responses in people's brains were very different. So that means if, in fact, we are in trouble, we literally do what people call keeping their wits about them. But we do it very well, and we're able to take ourselves through those situations much more easily. Now, if you had a horrible reaction to that, raise your hand. No, I'm kidding. Okay. So this is an overall slide. I'm going to break it down, and I'll go through it fairly quickly. But this is a slide that shows four ways that meditation affects the brain. And we know this now because we have the ability to measure these things. We didn't used to have it. But mostly with highly specialized electroencephalograms and with what are called functional MRIs, they literally take pictures of your brain and they show you how different it is in meditators and not meditators, and over periods of time. What happens if you've been meditating 3 months, 6 months, a year? What happens if you've been meditating, I keep wanting to say medicating, but it's not medicating, meditating decades? So we know how to look at this data. So the first thing is that it causes an increase in gray matter in these particular areas of the brain. And here's all I want to say to you about this. Our frontal cortex has an enormous amount to do with executive function, being able to learn, being able to remember. Actually, there's a lot of neural pathways that have to do with creativity that flow through there as well. It controls, helps us keep some lid on our emotions. You watch people who have frontal lobe damage, and they're very reactive. And those are people who can be very violent. They can't help it. They don't have neural pathways in place to control themselves. So when we increase the gray matter, all of those things I just said get better. Sorry to move quickly, but I want to get through this a little bit. The amygdala are two little areas in our brain that have to do with our emotional reaction to things and how we hold that, because we tend to hold on to negative experiences. We're literally wired to lean more towards negative experiences than positive ones by a factor of five. If you have two experiences that hold the same kind of emotion in them, one's positive and one's negative, you will hold on to that negative one five times more intensely and five times as long. That's another thing that's not fair. However, if we meditate, we can begin to alter the physiology in the amygdala, and we can start balancing those scales. This is an amazing thing to know. We can actually hold on to positive experiences for a longer period of time, and we can enjoy them longer, and we can retrain our brains. So we move from people who have a cup half empty to a cup half full, and it changes everything that goes on in our life. Can you imagine that? Everything. I'm going to just move through some of these slides. I'm just going to summarize those slides on this one to say, here are, because I'm looking at the clock and you're not, but time is running short. Increased attention definitely improves our memory by large degrees. Increase that functional connectivity with the brain, where I was telling you, they sort of start talking to each other and say, hey, we need your help here, or could you help here? And the whole brain starts working together in ways that we didn't know that it could. So this is a great thing that happens. Decrease reactivity to negative emotional stimuli. And really, in a way, the next thing I could say is it makes us smarter. It makes us learn more easily, and it makes us hold on to, helps us hold on to that knowledge for longer periods of time. So there's not really a downside here. You know, this is what I was saying, that there's no reason to not want to meditate. One more bit of good news. At age 50, the brains of people who have been meditating for, these are long-term meditators, 7.5 years younger in all of the modalities that they tested than their cohorts at 50 who didn't meditate. And that every year over 50 that we continue to meditate, we get 52 days younger. So, if you're interested in staying in your body longer, that's the good news. If you're actually really trying to get free, it may not be such good news. Okay, these are just summary slides. I just want to have a couple minutes to show you some of the actual data. But you can see here, it's not just psychiatric stuff. It's not just stress and depression. It's hypertension. It's cancer-related symptoms. It's GI disease. It's irritable bowel disease. I'll say it to you now, but way less people who have irritable bowel and inflammatory bowel disease, which is life-threatening disease, Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. Way less flares, way less pain, a much improved, response to how is your life, really? How they feel that their life is going. They enjoy themselves more. These are just by teaching people to meditate, mindfulness meditation, 12 to 15 minutes a day. This is pretty remarkable. Insomnia, tobacco, people quit smoking. The numbers are amazing. For insomnia, no matter what the insomnia is related to, you know, menopause-related insomnia has been the most difficult insomnia to treat. You speak to a lot of women who lose their estrogen. They don't sleep. But suddenly now, even studies with menopause-related insomnia, sleep way up. People have PTSD and don't sleep. Specifically, studies in PTSD and insomnia showing people are willing to learn how to meditate. Here's a slide that shows meditation and heart disease. What I want you to see is you want to be up higher because this is cumulative proportion of being event-free. So that green line, those people were learning TM, they have a much higher incidence when it comes to risk reduction in all-cause mortality. So that's heart disease, heart attacks, congestive heart failure, stroke, aneurysms, all cardiovascular disease. These are remarkable numbers. I hope, I'm moving fast and I'm sorry about that, but I'm here to tell you. This slide says that we now know that early meditators, 3 months, starts at 6 weeks, 3 months, lower their systolic blood pressure, you can't see this, by 4 millimeters, by 6 millimeters, and their diastolic by 4 millimeters of mercury pressure. That's how we measure blood pressure. Everybody likes to be 120 over 70 millimeters of mercury. Those numbers prove to be statistically significant to a large degree, just lowering blood pressure by that amount. You know, you have to ask yourself, why would you not? There is just not a logical answer to it. Here's this individuals with systolic top number hypertension. 32% of people could come off of one blood pressure medicine in 6 weeks. Blood pressure is a condition that we know traditionally we have to treat with 2 or 3 or 4 medicines, usually very hard to treat. Within a very short order, people start coming off of one medicine. That's pretty remarkable data again. This is more of the same. Meditation and cardiac rehabilitation. Rehabilitation, which is a very good thing that we discovered 20, 25 years ago. If people have a heart attack, we should be teaching them to eat differently and to exercise more. Now we find out where that says P equals 0.07. If you teach them to meditate, what are they measuring here? Cumulative mortality. This is after a heart attack already. Goes way down. That's a remarkable drop in numbers. I'm showing you these. That, by the way, is in the American Heart Journal. These are all of the best medical journals. I'm going to need to wind up here. All of these are saying more of the same. This is about back pain, remarkable numbers. Now the NIH says do not treat people with back pain, certainly not with surgery. Don't even give them medication. I mean, give them medicine if they're suffering, of course. Get them into a meditation program. That's out of NIH. And this is just another study there. This is a cute thing. I'm learning to relax, doctor, but I want to do it better, faster. You got to love America. This just says what we would know, that in psychiatric disease, it works particularly well. But the reason I did this is because these are studies that are based on all different types of meditation. Again, you can't see it in this slide, but mantra, mindfulness, TM, different types. So I'm saying whatever kind of meditation you do, it's going to be good for you, whatever you do. Now, I just want to comment on this one last slide, then I'll have to stop. This is the most meaningful slide that I'm showing you. This is saying how much are we decreasing healthcare dollars by teaching people to meditate in the emergency room, in the clinic, in specialty areas, by procedure. The only thing that doesn't go down are procedures. When you need to have your appendix out, you need to have your appendix out. Procedures don't change. But every other way, particularly visits to subspecialists, drop by 35%. So what these slides say, these series of slides, not that one. This says if you want to be able to do this, meditate and take yoga. But what that slide says, I mean, this is sort of all joking aside. This slide, the study shows that we could be saving billions with a B, billions of dollars, healthcare dollars, in the United States every year if we could increase the number of people who meditate. This is amazing data that has implications for every single one of us. And again, I mean, anybody in the room who doesn't, you have to ask yourself, why would you not? You just can't fathom. In every single way, I couldn't stop with it. Weight loss, I mean, it doesn't matter what you're working with. It's going to go better with meditation if you do it and take it seriously. You know, it's like any other program. It works if you work it. So you have to do it. Not always easy, but, you know, certainly not easy to have surgeries and to take drugs and to do all of the other things that we're talking about. Here's a beautiful slide I wanted to end with. Look at that. Does that slide just not speak to such a place of perfect balance? And I, of course, I know she's doing a hatha yoga. I don't even know if that's a true pose, but it doesn't matter. It's gorgeous. Look at the alignment. Look at the flexibility. Look at the centeredness. Look at the calm and the peace. I cannot guarantee you if you meditate for 6 weeks that you'll be able to do that. But I guarantee you you'll be 6 weeks closer to it. So, all right, everybody, thank you for coming.